We've got 1:30. Let's get moving. Yeshaya, we, God willing, are going to wrap up Perek Yedaleh, chapter 14 today. That's the goal, which includes not only the Babylonians, but also the Plishtim, the Philistines. So we have a lot of work ahead of us. My dream is that then next week we wrap up chapters 15 and 16 with Moab. Because why not, right? A guy can dream. It's in your hands. So we said, there you go.
The language here I found exceedingly hard.
Yes.
There were so many words that were like,
yes,
almost that I haven't heard.
Okay. There are a couple of words here that are entirely unique. We'll see it when we get there.
Am I right? It is a hard Hebrew.
Yeah, I mean, what Yeshaya is doing, and Gita actually forwarded me an article from Robert Alter about the challenge in translating work like Yeshaya's. Yeshaya is, on the one hand, conveying a message, but at the same time, he's creating poetic images, and at the same time, he's playing with sound. We're going to see some of that today, I hope. There are so many layers to the linguistics of what Yeshaya is doing that someone who's looking to read this straight is going to get frustrated. That's the truth. But let's go into it, because really there's so much to see, and the more time we have for it, the more we can actually talk about. We began the section of Yeshaya's addresses to the nations by noting that the audience, again, is really the Jews, and we suggested that what's going on here, as I just mentioned to Debbie, is either religious instruction, which is to say, God's going to punish people who do bad things, you should do good things, or God deals with everybody, don't think that God is just limited to his relationship with you, or it's a political message, don't look to these nations for alliances because their time is running out. Or in the case of the Babylonians, their time, which will begin at some point, will then run out. Because, of course, they haven't even risen to power. Now we're already predicting their downfall. But when we're dealing with the Babylonians, last time I gave you an outline of where things were going. I want to modify it slightly because I have greater clarity now than I did then. Chapter 13 was the invasion of Babylon. God summoning warriors, we talked about the cruelty of those warriors, we talked about the universal destruction, we talked about the Medes, right, Madai, and Babylon in ruins, and you know, descriptions of destruction so grave that the text doesn't even want to say it straight out. Then you had this two-sentence interlude, Jews are going to be okay. And in fact, the destruction of Babylon is meant to pave way for our return to Judea to build the Beis HaMikdash, to build the temple. And then you get chapter 14, the rest of chapter 14, or the rest of it that relates to the Babylonians at any rate, in which we get Babylon in ruins. So your first segment in chapter 13 was the invasion, the cruelty of it, the inevitability of it. And now what we find is the result of it. And that's what we're doing here. You see at the top of your sheet that I gave you an outline of what happens here in chapter 14. First, God addresses the Jews and tells us about the song we will sing when Babylon is in ruins. Then the question of how could this have happened to Babylon, which was so powerful. And then God turns to the Babylonians and mocks them, asking, how could this be? How could this have happened to you? You guys were so powerful. You said you were going to reign forever. Look at you. Before concluding with the death of the Babylonian Empire and, as you'll see, invocation of the Assyrians for reasons that we will have to discuss. But this chapter, fundamentally, the Babylonian portion of this is all about Babylon being in ruins as a result of what we read last week. And again, religious message, political message, intertwined. The theme of this section, where we talk about Babylon being in ruins, and the chief image that Yeshaya is drawing on here, is of highs and lows. You were high, you sought to become still higher, and instead, God brings you down. That's not unique to Babylon. That's a Tanakh-wide theme. When you think about Hannah's song after she has the son, Shmuel, she describes God as Mashpil Af Miromim. God brings low those who have been haughty and arrogant, and God elevates those who have been in the dumps. And of course, David HaMelech, King David in Tehillim. Right? How many times do you have to read a sentence like Mikimime Afar Dal? God raises up the needy or the pauper from the depths, a sentence which he cribs from Hannah, but that's okay. It's an over and over again theme of elevating the lowly and bringing down the arrogant. And that's what we're going to see here. If you take a look, it's page 977 in the Stone Tanakh. I want to just show you how the highs and lows play out. So we're going to go out of order within the chapter just to see that.
Chapter 14.
Verse? I'm getting there.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yes, much of it. Yeah, absolutely. Chapter 14, sentence 8 is a good starting point for this. Where we are going to describe, take a look. We're going to describe the Babylonians. Even I'm just going to use the English here for the sake of simplicity. Even the cypresses rejoice over you. When you collapse, the cypresses rejoice, the cedars of Lebanon, saying, from the time that you were laid low, the woodcutter would not come up against us. That's interesting, actually. Their way of translating the sentence is that the cypresses say, now we won't be attacked. But the other way to take the sentence is to say, you said that the woodchopper would never come against you. You said you would never be cut down. Are you with me here? Chapter 14, sentence 8. Yeah. You had thought that you would never be chopped down. The truth of the matter is, I understand their read of it. So let me forgive that line and say, read it the way they read it, that it's the cypress is saying they won't be cut down. I'll give you a better example. Go jump to sentence 12. Sentences 12 to 14 express explicitly the Babylonian urge to feel like they are way up high, untouchable, apart, aloof. With the sentence, how have you fallen from the heavens, O glowing morning star? We're going to come back to that morning star. There's a lot to say about that. Been cut down to the ground, O conqueror of nations. You said in your heart, I will ascend to the heavens. Higher than the stars of God, I shall raise my throne. I will sit at the mountain of meeting, also known as Mount Zion, on the northern side. We'll talk about that. I will ascend over the tops of the clouds. I will liken myself to the Most High. You, Babylonians, said, we are way, way, way up, and nobody can touch us. And God brings them low. Either like sentence 8 that we just read, they're the tree that has been chopped down. Or the image here, of being cut down to the ground in sentence 12, which is a reference to a tree being cut down. The Hebrew was nigdata, which is a term used to cut a branch or to cut the trunk of a tree. You are brought down to the depths, as we just saw. If you go to sentence 15, but to the netherworld have you been lowered, to the bottom of the pit. And not only that, but jump to sentence 19, 20. You have been flung from your grave like a detested tree shoot, like the garment of corpses pierced by the sword, which are lowered into the stones of a pit, like a trampled carcass. This is a chapter of highs and lows. You thought you were untouchably high, and in fact, you are dragged down to be the lowest of the low. And the capstone to this is fantastic. Sentence 22. God says, I will rise up against them. The word of Hashem, master of legions. Vikamti alehem. In other words, who is the possessor of true height, of true elevation? God. You thought you're going to be God-like way up in the heavens. You're cast down. God is the one who rises above. So that's your theme in this section, is highs and lows. Now let's take it a little bit by bit. Jean, you were going to say? Or?
No.
Okay. You don't have to be afraid to say something. It's okay. So go back to page 977, sentence 3, where we begin this mockery of Babylon, Babylon in ruins. Sentences 3 and 4 are, here is the song that you are going to sing at the fall of Babylon. Here is what you are going to say. V'nasata ha-mashal hazeh al-melech Babel. You will raise up this mashal, this lesson. It's usually a poetic lesson. Upon the king of Babylon, v'amarta, and you are going to say, Ech shavas noges. How was it that the noges, the oppressor, right, think from Egypt, the Noxim, the oppressors, the slave drivers, how is it that they halted? Shavsa Madheva. Madheva came to a halt. There are all sorts of different approaches to what Madheva means. They will translate it here as, what do they do? Arrogance. Huh, that's boring. Okay. The Madheva, according to Rashi, is somebody of great weight or status. Radak says it is a rod or a scepter. Malbim, though, is fascinating. Hebrew and Aramaic often switch Zion and Dalet. So, for example, the word in Hebrew for a male is Zachar, right? The word in Aramaic is Dichra, with a definite object having the Aleph at the end. But Zion and Dalet will often switch. So here, Malbim sees Madheva as being Zahav, really. It's gold, the city of gold, or the empire of gold. And then you have a midrash that takes Madheva as a compound. Midod Vahave, measure and bring. It was their call for wealth to be brought to them. But the point isn't that. The point is that the Jews are going to say, how could this have happened? How was it that they came to all? This is the song that we are going to sing upon our redemption. And it's a song about the fall of Babylon. And, as we're going to see, a song about the fall of Nebuchadnezzar specifically. Some of this is going to be personal about Nebuchadnezzar. Susan?
It says here that, like, it says about the gold that Targum says it should be gold.
Okay.
And then it says, and modern scholars agree in changing the dollar tone and understand the word and in 1803, and then brackets. This is a different time.
Okay. I have not. I'm skeptical, but I don't know what he's basing it on. I haven't read the authors he's suggesting, so I don't know what convinces them to do that.
Rashi says it means pride.
Right. Rashi does have what was it? I said the great weight or status. Yes, those are, and that's why the art scroll does it. The art scroll is following Rashi when it says arrogance. Right, because he's using the gold of, like Malbim does, of Zahav. The Zion Dalet is a well-trod path. That's what gives it merit. But what you're saying is about Babylon. How could it be in ruins? How could the events of chapter 13 have befallen Babylon? And then you get this direct mockery addressing Babylon personally with sentences 8 to 12, which we already read. So we're not going to do it again. We read it in the first couple of minutes of the class today. But it's turning to them. You were laid low. The netherworld below trembles to greet your arrival. It's talking to Babylon directly. But here's something in particular that is fascinating. When I listed the highs and the lows that are in this chapter, one of the themes was rising to the heavens, which we're going to come back to. The other was of trees. Right? We said the Korate, the one who cuts down the trees. The nations are compared to Beroshim, which they render here as cypresses. They say, Nigdata, you were cut down like a tree. What is the message in comparing Babylon to a tree that has been cut down? Oh, trees do grow back. Not all trees. Yeah. No, trees grow back.
Takes many, many, many years. They're huge. They're mighty. They're inspiring. I mean, there are a lot of words you can attach to trees that are mature. And the cedars of Lebanon.
Right.
A great
right.
Obviously, it's something that's towering and impressive right. powerful.
Right. So I think you have three layers here, at least three layers. One metaphorical, one literal, and one intertextual. First of all, metaphor. Right? The tree is a powerful entity. Rashi and Abarbanel take the approach. It's a metaphor for leadership. That's the idea. I brought you in source number 2. Rashi on these trees that are rejoicing says, Gam Broshim Samchu, the Broshim also rejoice. I didn't translate Broshim because I've seen too many different translations. I've seen it as pines, I've seen it as cypresses, and what do I know? So I just said it's Broshim. You know, if it moves you to say cypresses, good for you. But these trees rejoice. Look at Rashi. He's quoting you the Targum. Ach Shiltonin Chadiu. Shiltonin, rulers, rejoiced. Samchu amapalatcha, they're happy at your downfall. The trees represent rulers. It's a metaphor.
They're not rulers. I mean, a mature tree is rooted, so it gives an impression of permanence. It's awesome in size.
Yeah.
It's very large.
It's an image of power.
Power, yeah.
Power and permanence. They are semi-permanents anyway, because, you know, we cut down our trees. But that's one way to look at it. We're in chapter 14, sentences 8 to 11.
I found it.
Okay, good.
I just wanted to say something. The tree in those days, whether it was for Babel, and unfortunately even for Bnei Israel, sometimes took on sacred meaning, and I think that somewhere the Asherah, or whatever it may have been. So
interesting.
Somewhere it could be.
It's an interesting idea to suggest that it's associated with idolatry. I don't know that the Babylonians had tree worship.
The
Babylonians.
I was reading a book.
Yeah.
It's not specifically, but wood and things like that.
Okay. It's an interesting idea. I hadn't thought about it from that frame of reference. I'd have to know more about Babylonian tree worship and Broshim in particular, whether that would have had any resonance for them. Yeah.
My little student's guide that I rely on.
Oh, no, I'm not there yet.
No.
Yeah, but I'm not there yet. Just wait till I go through my three layers, and then we can go to that.
Oh, okay, because
yeah.
This gives a very literal sort of...
Ibn Ezra takes a literal approach, and he says, the trees are literally rejoicing because they're spared from being cut down to make a siege. Is that what you...
No.
Okay, good, then we're not there yet. Take a look at source number 3. You know why the trees are happy? Hatam shayem etzavel lichrot habroshim v'harazim livnot matzor v'soleila. He says, the issue was that the Babylonians would lay siege to a city. So they would cut down the trees for the siege, right, like the Torah says not to do. Or they would use it as fill against the wall if they want to climb up and get over the ramparts. So they would use the trees for that purpose. The trees rejoice at the fall of Babylon, because now the trees are going to survive. It's a very literal read of the rejoicing of the trees. Doesn't explain the Babylonians as trees exactly. But I think there's a third approach here. Yeah.
We learn also about Mashiach, that it's like a shoot comes out. And
yeah.
Here at the end it talks about they're going to be left without progeny, or the rulers. So maybe it's going to be cut down like a tree that is permanently...
The loss, in other words, this is really referencing where it's going to go. Right. Future generation. Could be. It could be that it's talking about a future generation. I hear you. But I think there's an intertextual element which you can't miss, which is really important to the way we read this. And that goes back to Daniel. Some of you were here when we did Daniel, and so you remember this this story, but it's quite a few years ago. The first four chapters of the book of Daniel give us the arc of Daniel's relationship with Nebuchadnezzar. In chapter 1, Nebuchadnezzar orders the Jewish youths of fine character and appearance and so on to be brought to stand in his temple, and they have to eat the scraps from his table, and Daniel becomes a vegetarian. That's chapter 1. In chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream which scares him, and he doesn't know what it's about, and he calls all of his advisors and sages, and he says, either tell me what I dreamed and what it means, or I'm going to kill the lot of you, have you torn into pieces. And Daniel saves the day by explaining that it's a vision of, it's a big, great big statue made of different materials, each one representing one of the future empires. The idea that each age has a material associated with it, go look at the poet Hesiod for more of that. But the point is that Daniel explains this as a vision that the Babylonian Empire will fall and we will be replaced by the next one, who will be replaced by the next one, until Mashiach comes and God sets up the Jews as the final empire. Then you get the third chapter. And in the third chapter, Nebuchadnezzar rebels against the vision. And he makes a statue entirely of gold. And orders that when music is played, all of the leaders of all of the lands are going to have to gather in Babylon. And when the music plays, they bow to this statue, as in accepting Babylon forever. The Babylonian Empire, the gold one from that original dream, is going to last forever, and there are no replacements for Babylon. And that's the story where Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah refuse to bow. Daniel is out of town. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah refuse to bow to this statue, and they're thrown into the fiery furnace, and they survive. Dot, dot, dot. Chapter 4 is the key. Because in chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar has his second dream. And in his second dream, does anyone remember what he envisions? He envisions a great tree. And it has branches, and it has leaves, and it has fruit, and all the birds come and settle the branches, and the animals take shelter underneath the branches, and everyone loves this dear tree. And then, the tree is chopped down. And it is left out in the elements for a period of 7 seasons, and it's rained on, and then after the seven seasons, at that point the announcement is made, it may now regrow. And the stump is left there for that. And Daniel explains to Nebuchadnezzar that which really sure had been obvious to him, and maybe it was obvious, he just didn't want to say so, which is that he is the tree. The tree is the king, who is so powerful, the provider for everybody, and that he is going to be chopped down. And to make a long story short, Nebuchadnezzar goes through a feral period, a period where he wanders. Barbanel thinks that it's some kind of depression. He wanders, he leaves the palace, he grows his hair long, he grows his nails long, he doesn't interact with anybody, and at the end of 7 seasons, things turn around, and he accepts God, recognizes God, and he returns to his throne. That story is going to matter for a few things today. But the reason why I take us through all of that here is because look what we're predicting. The tree being chopped down. It feels to me like this is, as I said, intertextual. The idea here is that it's a prediction. The tree is going to be chopped down. Nebuchadnezzar, and again, this is personal, it's not only about the Babylonian Empire as a whole, it's about this man, is going to suffer this experience of being the tree that is chopped down. There were a couple of hands. No? I made it up. Okay, Janine.
I've done that before, but the consequences are very different in those two places. In Daniel, that tree regrows, and here they're saying it's final.
Right. Correct. The prediction of Yeshaya is much stronger than the prediction of Daniel to Nebuchadnezzar, which makes sense, because Daniel's prediction is, and the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, is about the man only. And he does come back to the throne. Whereas this is really, even though I've mentioned it's personal to Nebuchadnezzar, it's also about the kingdom, which once the Persians and the Medes destroy it, never becomes what it had once been. Never regains that glory.
Could Daniel's prediction be about this, like, somewhat earlier time? And this is about,
well, it is. That's what I'm saying. Nebuchadnezzar is not the last king. Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar comes back. And Evil Merodach reigns after him, and Belshazzar is after him, and then the Persians and Medes come through. But the dream really seems to be about Nebuchadnezzar personally. We find other messages as far as Belshazzar. So what you're seeing here is the statement, how could you have been cut down, you mighty tree? Debbie, what did you have there?
Much more literal. Almost.
What do you got?
Even the trees rejoiced that Nebuchadnezzar would cut them no more. He used to cut down the trees of Israel and transplant them to Babylon.
Oh. That's interesting.
The problem is that it doesn't give sources.
Oh.
Got
it. Oh, all right. Okay. So we get this description here. Jump to sentence 9, please.
What's the timeline? Now, Neil, you see.
No, Daniel is long after Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu, remember, is still in the first temple time, and at this stage, the Assyrians have not yet destroyed the northern kingdom even. You've got more than a century to go.
Right, so you say intertextual. So what you're saying is that Daniel obviously picked up on the image.
Not necessarily. That's an important methodological question. When you use the term intertextual, what do you mean by that? And what I mean when I use the word intertextual is only that there are links between sections in Tanakh that flesh out the meaning in each other, but not as a literary device to suggest that the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah or whoever sat down and said, hey, let's link this story with this one, but that this is in fact the nature of prophecy. That what's being Yeshayah's prophecy is of something that hasn't happened yet and is going to play out and be discussed in the book of Daniel. That's the way that that I look at intertextuality.
It's a proof text?
Not so much a proof text, but they're both describing the same event. And by seeing both, you know what it's like. For those who don't read Toronto Torah every week, first of all, shame on you. Rabbi Ziering wrote something fascinating last week in the Tanakh column. We have a Tanakh column. We started in the beginning of Yeshua. We're now early on in Shoftim. And he was talking about Devorah. And how he quoted a writer, Judy Klitzner, who points out that when you take the story of Devorah and how she tells Barak what to do in this war against Canaan, and then you couple it with Esther's story and what Esther does with Mordechai, you get a more complicated understanding and textured understanding, really, of the dynamics of women and men and leadership in Tanakh. If you only read one of the stories, you only get one dimension. You need multiple to get a more thorough and deep understanding of what's going on, and that's what I feel like happens here. That's what I'm saying. And yes, you should read Toronto Torah every week. Yes.
This says where the Lebanon came from, the tree study.
Yeah.
It says CF, I don't know what's the ECS HAB period 2:17, chapter 2:17.
Habakkuk.
CF first.
Yeah, yeah. No, because there is a pasuk in Habakkuk about Broshim. So, okay.
That's where it said that they cut down the trees, but okay. That was their way.
All right. Thank you. So, we've seen the idea of the Babylonians as a tree that is chopped down, causing the other trees to rejoice, whether that's in relief or what. And then take a look at sentence 9. Sha'ol mitachas. Yes.
Could it also be a symbol? A tree could last, there's some trees 500, 600 years old. So, but obviously the Babylonians are far from that.
Right. So I don't know the nature of trees in Persia and in Babylon to know what sort of trees they would have had and would they have imagined the trees to be that enduring. But yes, certainly the way we think of it, as something that left to its own devices, it will stand there for a very long time. I don't know. I'd be curious. Flora of Babylon. I think it's a legitimate question. Would they have seen a tree as a symbol of something that endures? But look at this, because we really have to see it. In sentence 9, Sho'ol mitachas ragza l'chalik ras bo'echa, the depths, the grave, they tremble to greet you. Orer lecha rifa'im, the rifa'im awake for you. So Rifa'im, they take here as giants. I would be surprised though if all of our translations render it as giants and none of them render it as ghosts. Anyone have ghosts for Rifa'im?
Shades,
right. Ghosts, it's the dead. Rifa'im is often that way. We had this discussion in Iyov when Rifa'im were invoked towards the end of the book of Job. And that fits a lot better. Right, we're talking about the grave, and the grave is agitated, and the ghosts in the grave are all awaiting their arrival. They call out today Aretz, the leaders of the land. Atudim are the sheep that lead the flock. Hekim mikisotam kol malche goyim, the kings of nations all rise from their thrones. So most commentators take this to that everybody's really happy at the fall of Babylon and they're just like coming out to greet you. It's a welcome party. About time, Babylon. However, Radach says no, it's actually in fear of the Babylonians, because these were all people who were killed by the Babylonians. Like, we don't want them here. Either way, I'm going to jump to sentence 12. Because sentence 12 is one you got to take a minute on. Ech nafalta mishamayim Halel ben Shachar. How did you fall from the heavens, Halel ben Shachar, and Nigdat al Aretz, you were cut down, that's the tree image, to the ground, Cholesh al Goyim, the one who cast lots upon the nations. The casting lots is an interesting image in and of itself. The Talmud in Shabbat talks about Nebuchadnezzar casting lots upon the empires he conquered, and which leader he's going to abuse on a given day. But I want to talk about Halel ben Shachar. Here, in the Art Scroll, they translated it as the morning star. The glowing morning star. Anyone have something different in their translations?
Yeah. Bright star.
Oh, bright star. What do you got?
Son of Don. Don has a capital D, and the note says a character in some lost myth.
Son of Don. A character in lost myth. Okay. None of you have Lucifer? You're doing the commentary. Okay, now we're talking. Okay, so what in the world is this about? The simple explanation is that the word Halel is like a word we've seen before, Yahel Oro, which means to shine light. Halel, the radiant one, Ben Shachar, son of the dawn. That's the simple read. That's Ibn Ezra's read. I brought it for you in source number 4. He says, Hakarov el adat shu kochav noga. He says, the most likely is it is kochav noga. I wasn't sure if he meant Venus, which is what we translate noga as today. Today the word noga is used to mean Venus. I don't know if he meant that, or if he meant a star that shines light, because noga is light. Ve'aed ben shachar. And he says, look, it says, son of dawn. Shahunir akarov me'alot ha-shachar be'amim yiduim, because this star is visible close to dawn on certain days. Ve'ein be'kochavim v'tzva sherem kulo kochav me'ir l'marei ha'ayin kamo'u. There's no other star or heavenly body that illuminates like it. And he says, al-kein nikra Halel, therefore it's called Halel, and he quotes that pasuk, lo yahelu oram, which again is a reference to shining light. So Ibn Ezra says what it just means is the morning star. That's one idea. Rashi, in source number 5, says this isn't just about the star. You gave it a name. Halel ben Shachar. You didn't just say shining light. So Rashi says, as I brought you in number 5, that it's about the angel of Babylon. The idea that every nation has a malach, has an angel that represents it in the heavens, and it is being cast down. That's the Halel ben Shachar thrown down to the ground. The Malbim develops this idea. Take a look at source number 6. It's longer, so I'm just going to read you the English. It is known that ancient nations attributed national success to the stars, and they said that the star of their success in the heavens shone upon them and radiated light. Thus it compares his star to the light of, quote, the sun of morning, meaning the light which begins to shine from the eastern horizon. For the star which is at the ascension of morning and shining does not set, but rather it rises. So it's saying, how could you have fallen back from heaven to earth? And the lesson behind the metaphor, you were at the height of success and ascension, how did you fall so suddenly? So that's another take, is that it's about their heavenly forces that are on their side. And then, the church really likes this image. And the Vulgate, the King James, take it as Lucifer, son of the morning. Why? What does Lucifer mean?
Light.
Luce. Right at the beginning. Lucifer is light. Right? That's what this is. This is Halel ben Shachar. That made me wonder if Halel was somehow associated with hell, like in, you know, that's where it came, but I looked up the etymology. It's not. That's from the word hole. Boring. Susan.
The Bible says the ben Shachar is the or Lucifer light bearer, the morning star, son of the morning, under the name of Ishtar. I think that's Ishtar that we say.
The problem is that that's Persian.
Worshipped by the Babylonians, and the Nebuchadnezzar's day values of power and glory are well represented by the comparison with the shining star. So they're saying Lucifer, Babylonian worship Ishtar, and therefore Lucifer being the son of Ishtar is going back to...
But I thought Ishtar was Persian.
Well, Ishtar, there's no...
No, it's the same thing. Hey, someone who's listening to this recording is going to email me an update and answer me. I have certain people who listen to the recordings, and they have the benefit of having Google in front of them. And so I will rely on them to give me an update on the relationship between Ishtar.
I'm not arguing, it's just...
Okay. But the... Right. Well, that's the big problem that I have. It's a very entertaining idea, but why would the devil be associated with the Babylonians, as opposed to anybody else? You know, I would have associated him with, you know, Rome and Edom or something like that, maybe. Why Babylon? So I'm not clear on that, but that's the... Halil ben Shachar is just such an attractive phrase because it's humanized. You know, it's got the anthropomorphic element of giving it a name. It didn't just say the morning star.
I think we have to also keep in mind that that part of the world, they were great astrologers, mm-hmm. and they believed very much in watching the stars and the skies, and they had names for everything.
Absolutely. Malbim loves that idea, that this is tied into their astrology. Absolutely. So the statement here is... How could you have been cut down, you mighty tree? Your star, which had been so bright, right? Think of that metaphorically, obviously, but also literally. Your star, you had been way, way up, and now is cast down. And then look at sentences 13 and 14. This is so much fun. Ve'ata amarta bilavavcha. You said in your heart, you, Babylon, you, Nebuchadnezzar, Hashamayim Eileh, I'm going to go up to the heavens. Mimal lekochvei kel arim kisi, I am going to raise my throne above these stars, these powerful stars or the stars of God. Ve'eshev behar moed v'yarketei tzafon, I will sit on Har Tzion. Yarketei tzafon, if you remember from Tehillim, Har Tzion, yarketei tzafon, right? It's in the Song of the Day for Mondays. It's a reference to Mount Zion and the site of the Beit HaMikdash, the site of the temple. I brought you Rashi. If you flip the page for a minute to source number 8, he tells you this. Har Moed is the mountain where everybody gathers. That's Mount Zion. Yarketei Tzafon, Yerech is what? What's a Yerech? A thigh. Right? It's the side of something. The Yarketei Tzafon, the north side. In the temple, the holiest place was the northern half of the sanctuary facing the Holy of Holies. So that the north side of the altar was where you sacrificed the highest level offerings. So that's where you said you were going to be, and instead you were brought down. However, here's some things that I find very interesting. This image about saying they were going to be so lofty. I brought you the passage in the Talmud first, in source number 7. It's very funny. Funny in the sense of, like, as mockery of Nebuchadnezzar. I did not translate it, because the translation would be worthless. And you'll see what I mean, because I'm going to translate it now. You'll see what I mean. What was the answer given to him by the bat kol, the small voice that was sent out to that wicked one when he said, I'm going to go rise up in the heavens, I'll be like God? What was the answer? A voice came out of the heavens and said to him, Rasha, son of a Rasha, grandson of Nimrod the Rasha, who caused the world to rebel against God, how long does a person live? 70 years. Right, quotes the verse from Psalms, 70 years, 80 years, whatever it is, 150, whatever. He says, from the earth to the heavens would take you 500 years to walk it. Then, the width of the heavens is another 500 years. And so too between each of the seven heavens is another 500 years, and 500 years for each of the heavens themselves. Then above that you have the holy chayot, and the legs of the chayot are as tall as all of the things that you just listed, and then the ankles of the chayot, maybe before it was the feet, are as tall as everything you listed, and then you have the thighs of the chayot that are as tall as everything you listed, and then you have, and so on, through all the chayot, and their bodies, and their necks, and their horns, and then you have the divine throne, and then God above the divine throne. Who are you kidding, Nebuchadnezzar? You're never getting there. You won't live long enough. Now, the meaning of the 500 years is fascinating in its own right. It's a mystical concept. It's not meant to be taken literally, but now you understand why I wasn't going to sit there translating this. You can just add up the number of years it would take you to walk to God. The message here is a very literal one. You said you were going to be way, way up. Parenthetically, let's go back to, I didn't bring it here, I should have. The image of Nebuchadnezzar and his tree dream, in that same chapter, Daniel gives him a piece of advice. He says, if you want to delay your fate of being chopped down, what should you do? Anyone remember? Let's do Daniel again. He said, give tzedakah. He says, help the indigent, and then it will delay your punishment. And for 12 months, that's what Nebuchadnezzar does, until he is walking on the roof of his palace, and he looks out at his empire, and he says, wow, I built all this. And at that point, his arrogance causes the punishment to come upon him. The idea is that when he has humbled himself to hand out to people in need, then he doesn't deserve the punishment. But if he becomes arrogant, then the punishment comes upon him. So the... I just wonder about that and the passage here. He goes up walking on the roof, and here talking about how he said he would be above everything. So the Talmud takes it literally. I said I would be above everybody. I would be like God. Abarbanel says, come on. Look at verse number 9. Shehu bihishtadlusso vihishchak muso. In his efforts and in his plotting, chashav levatel hamaaracha ha'elyona v'gzerah ha'charuta. There you go, Meira. He thought to cancel the constellations, right? The decree of the stars. He thought he would cancel the decree that had been inscribed up in the heavens. Lo sheyachshav la'alot la'shamayim. Not that he thought he's going to climb up to the heavens. V'lo lehidamot le'elyona yitbarach, or that he's going to become like God. Who rasha haya lo shote? He's wicked. He's not a fool. That's the way that Abarbanel reads it. I like that line. So you were so lofty. You were so mighty. You said you were going to be so great, and instead, everything will be shocked at your downfall and disgrace. And Paul, here we come back to the layers of game. Not Paul, Susan. Sorry, the layers of games going on in the language of Yeshaya. Take a look at sentence 15, please. It's not in sentence. Sorry, it's in 19. But we have to read 15 to get there. So we're starting from 15. Only you will be brought down to the depths, to the sides of the pit. Those who see you will look at you, they will contemplate and say, is this the man who shook the earth, who rattled the empires? Sentence 17. The one who made Tevel, civilization, like a wilderness. We read that word last week. He destroyed all the cities. He didn't free all the captives. Those captives do not get let out. All of the kings of the nations lay down in honor, each one in his own house. And you, Nebuchadnezzar, sentence 19. You have been cast out of your grave. We're going to come back to that phrase. You have been cast out of your grave like what? What does it say next? Like what? I can't hear everybody. I should have asked one by one. Susan, what do you have? Like a?
Abhorrent offshoot.
Like an abhorrent offshoot? You have? An abhorrent branch? That's roughly what everybody has?
No, loathsome carrion.
Like loathsome carrion. That's cool. What does it say in the Hebrew? What does it say in the Hebrew?
Netzer. It's the same thing.
Can Netzer nit'av?
Netzer is a remnant.
Netzer is indeed a shoot.
Netzer is the thing that...
Who is named Netzer? Choter. The Netzer Mishar Shaviyafra, the second half of the sentence. But it is a shoot there. That's what it is. But what? But who else? Who's named Netzer? Uh-oh. Nebuchadnezzar. Netzer Nitav is a play on Nebuchadnezzar. Yeshaya is punning. Then you wonder why it's hard to read this. But he's having fun. I don't, fun is probably the wrong word for a vision like this. But Yeshaya is working on so many different linguistic levels at the same time. So yes, this is a pun, I believe, on Nebuchadnezzar, but he's describing how he is going to be reviled and he's going to be cast out of his grave. And so it continues the rest of the of sentence 19 and sentence 20. You won't be buried with the kings. You destroyed your land. You killed your own nation. You are never going to have any descendants. That's the statement to Nebuchadnezzar. And yes, that fits the idea of the tree being cut down, that there is no future. So it fits that very well. But there are a few things that I want to try to note here that I think we have time to do. First of all, the image of being cast out of his grave is a very interesting one. It's going to come up later on, much later on, when Chizkiyahu drags the body of his father, King Ahaz, through the streets. So the image of not getting a burial is an image of disgrace. That's the way Rashi reads it. If you take a look at Rashi in source number 10, when the text says, you ruined your land. So Rashi says, ki artzecha shichata, for you ruined your land. Barov avodah, you made them all work. Va'amcha haragta chinam, and you killed your nation for nothing, as in the passage from Daniel, where he wants to kill all the sages of Babylon, because they can't explain what he dreamed. Lekach sanucha, so they hate you, Nebuchadnezzar. V'noagubacha bizayon, they disgraced you, la'shichacha mikivracha, casting you out of your grave. And that's one read. But then you get this midrash, which is just fascinating. What happened to the throne of Babylon while Nebuchadnezzar was wandering for seven seasons or years? Who was on the throne? So there are multiple explanations that are offered. One explanation I saw that's very interesting is that there was a queen who actually took charge during that period of time. I've tried to find historical evidence to support it. I have not found any. Doesn't mean it's not there. I just haven't found it. A second suggestion is nobody sat on that throne because you didn't mess with Nebuchadnezzar and you did not want to be sitting there when he came walking back in the door. That, to me, is the most logical explanation. But look at this midrash, which picks up on the fact that we are taught that a man by the name of Evil Merodach took the throne after Nebuchadnezzar, and it's not clear how he fits into the family line. Is he his son? Is he somebody else? Not entirely clear. So take a look at this midrash that I quoted you in source number 11. It's playing on a verse from Habakkuk, which says that the Chaldeans are frightening and awful. From them, their laws and rules emerge. So the text tries to figure out, what does that mean? From them, their laws and rules emerge. And it suggests, frightening and awful refers to Nebuchadnezzar. Why? Because you said in your heart, Nebuchadnezzar, you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. That's how he is so frightening. He is so mighty. From them, their laws and rules emerge. This is Evil Merodach. What are you talking about? Meaning that the laws and rules that punish Nebuchadnezzar emerge via Evil Merodach. Evil Merodach becomes the agent for the punishment of Nebuchadnezzar. How? How does that happen? They said, during the 7 years that passed upon Nebuchadnezzar, they made Evil Merodach. Yes, I know, it looks like evil. It's an unfortunate thing, but it's not. It's Aleph Vav Yud Lamed. They made Evil Merodach king in his place. When he returned, when Nebuchadnezzar returned, he took Evil Merodach and jailed him. When Nebuchadnezzar died, they went back to Evil Merodach to coronate him. He said, I'm not listening to you. I listened to you before, and he took me and jailed me. This time, he'll kill me when he comes back. And he didn't believe them until they dragged out Nebuchadnezzar and cast him before him. Thus it says, they cast you from your grave. Rabbi Akiva said, Rabbi Avina said, not only that, But each of his enemies came and stabbed him with a sword, fulfilling the verse, which is part of that same verse in Habakkuk. I'm sorry, which is a verse from here. In the clothing of the executed, pierced by the sword. That was sentence 19 in our chapter. So the idea here is that it's not random that he's getting dragged. He's getting dragged because they don't believe he's dead. They want proof that Nebuchadnezzar is actually dead, and so he is cast out of his grave. Radak and Abarbanel take it entirely differently. And they say, kever doesn't have to mean grave. Kever can mean house. Because you thought you were going to stay there forever, Nebuchadnezzar. Like a person stays in the grave for a long period of time. That's what Nebuchadnezzar thought. So I brought you Radak in number 12. I'm not going to read it out loud because I've already explained it. But he says, the idea is you thought you were going to stay in your house. You are cast out when Nebuchadnezzar becomes wild and leaves the palace. So what we've seen again, let's make sure that we're clear here as we enter the last part. This is, again, a theme of highs and lows. The previous chapter was all about the cruelty of the invasion. The Medes, the fear we have of them, how destructive they are, how they don't take bribes, and so on. This is about the aftermath. It is about the high being cut down, the tree being chopped down, the star being cast down, the king thrown out of his grave, thrown out of his palace, being forced to go feral. That's the image that you're going to see here, and it culminates in sentences 21 to 23, as Babylon is dead and there is no heir. And we already started seeing that in sentence 20, but it continues in sentences 21 to 23, especially if you look at sentence 22. V'echvati l'Bavel, I am going to cut off, God says, for Babylon, any remnant, not a son, not a grandson, not a great-grandson. God says, I'm going to cut off all heirs for Babylon. Malbin, though, makes an interesting point. Look again at sentence 21. Malbin notes that there are two things going on here in this sentence. Why is God going to do this to Babylon? Why is he going to cut off any heir from Babylon? In sentence 21? One reason is Ba'avon Avotam, because of the sins of their ancestors. The second reason is Bal Yakumu V'Yarshuaret, lest they rise up and do it again. So in other words, as this is Malbim's point, there are two concerns here. Punishing Babylon, number one, and number two, preventing them from rising again. Both of these are elements. And then we get to a side note, which I wanted to make sure to mention because of Susan's frustration with the language that we talked about, 51 minutes ago. They take a look at sentence 23. This is a good example. Visamtia lemorash kipod. I am going to make Babylon into the inheritance of, or the place of the kipod. Do they do kipod as a porcupine here? Hedgehog. Hedgehog. Okay, that's good enough. I don't even know the difference. What? Wild birds? Seriously, that's not fun.
It's also some sea urchin, as far as I know.
Well, it's the same idea, right? The spikes.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
The point is, it's a ruin. That's the idea. V'agmei mayim, and you'll have these pools of water, and then the next words. V'teite siha b'mitate hashmeid. What in the world is that?
Getting ready for Pesach, apparently. Yeah.
Yes. These are words that do not appear elsewhere in Tanakh.
No.
They don't appear anywhere else. And the Talmud has this great discussion about all the words that the sages did not know in the period of the Mishnah. But Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, credited with leading canonization of the Mishnah, has maids in his house who are very wise, and they use these words, and that way the students find out what the words mean. This is one of them, when she talks about using a broom to sweep things out, and that's where we get the word mitate. In fact, in modern Hebrew, is a broom. That's what this is. This is sweeping them out with the broom of devastation. So, yes, Yeshayah is a hard read. And not only for us. you need Amsa Dede Rebbe. You need Rebbe's maid in order to explain what the word means. The other note on that, with this business about the dust and sweeping them out with destruction, I couldn't resist source number 13. The story of Mar Brei de Ravina, one of the sages from the Gemara. Kiavamati Lebavel, when he would arrive in Babylon, have a shakil afra besudre vishadi levra. He would take dirt in his sudar. Sudar is a cloth often used to make a turban. So he would unwrap it, and he would pick up some dirt in it, and he would throw it away to fulfill this pasuk. I will sweep it with a broom of destruction, right? You know about people like bowing down to kiss the ground when they get into Israel? Well, here when people get to Babylon, they take some dirt and they throw it in order to fulfill this sentence. If you're familiar with the context in the Gemara and Brachos, you understand why. That's the section where it talks about seeing areas where God has created punishment. And how one responds. The last bit of this section, we're not going to get to the Philistines today, that's pretty clear. But the last section here about Babylon, sentences 24 to 27, gives us their fall, but it mentions the Assyrians. Right? We're on page 979, and the question is, who threw in the Assyrians? What's their business in this discussion? Look what it says. In sentence 24, God said, He swore, if I am not going to do as I said I was going to do, so it came to pass, as I planned, that's what's going to happen, which is a theme throughout Yeshaya, that whatever God says is going to happen, is going to happen. Everybody else plots and it falls apart, utsu eitz of it too far, not God. And then he says, to break the Assyrians in my land, and to trample them on my mountains, his yoke is going to leave them. And the problem is, I don't understand what you're talking about. What Assyrians? The Babylonians conquered the Assyrians. How does this fit a vision for the fall of Babylon? Who threw the Assyrians in here? And he continues to say, this is the plot upon the entire land, and God's hand outstretched upon all of the nations, because God has planned, and who in his right mind is going to defy God's plan? Nobody can stop it. God's hand is extended, just like it was on the Syro-Ephraimite alliance. We saw four times, Od Yadonit Tuyah. God's arm is outstretched. His arm is outstretched here, and nobody can do anything about it. But what are the Assyrians here for? So just because we're down to the last couple of minutes, I'll tell you. Source number 14 is the Talmud's approach, and it says that this is actually a separate vision. It's not about Babylon. It's about Assyria. And the statement is that God says, I need to swear that I'm going to demolish the Assyrians, because if I tell Hezekiah the Assyrians are coming, but don't worry, he's going to worry. He's going to say, just don't bring them in the first place. So therefore, God swears, I'm going to bring them and I'm going to destroy them. That source number 14 is that it's actually about the Assyrians. However, the commentators in general don't take that view. Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Dat Mikra, they take it as God saying, my plan regarding the Assyrians came true, and so my plan regarding Babylon is going to come true as well. And so believe me, Nebuchadnezzar, that devastation is coming just like to the Assyrians. Last approach is Abarbanel's approach. I brought it for you in number 16, but I'm saying it outside, which is, it's about Nebuchadnezzar who rules in the land of the Assyrians, because he conquered the Assyrians. We saw a similar thing in Ezra and Nehemiah. We said that the king of a conquered land becomes known as the king of that land. So it's possible, Herodotus does this, it's possible to say he's actually talking to Nebuchadnezzar and calling him the king of Assyria because he conquered Assyria. However you read it, I'll get to yours in a second. However you read it, the conclusion here, and I want to summarize, the conclusion of this whole section of highs and lows is the Babylonians have to know, and it's not really the Babylonians knowing it, it's the Jews knowing it, that number one, punishment comes to the wicked, and that's going to include the Babylonians. God is calling the shot far in advance. And number two, don't look to the Babylonians for help. You're looking to the Assyrians to help you against the Syro-Ephraimite alliance. You think that's going to help you? Then the Assyrians are going to come under fire from the Babylonians. You think the Babylonians are going to save you from the Assyrians? That's not the way it works. Don't trust them. They rise, they become arrogant, and they fall. Susan, last note?
It says here that it's
that they believe it to be a Syrian to show that God is going to do this to any nation
right.
who rises up. That
right.
Like you find out in Syrians, the Jews, Babylonians, and anybody else.
Yeah. Right. Them and the horse they rode in on. They're all gone. Okay?
The Assyrians have not been defeated yet. It's
no. The Assyrians haven't yet destroyed the temple. The Assyrians, not the temple, the northern kingdom. It's all completely in the future. Yeshaya is calling the whole thing, which is why I go back to what I said in the beginning of this section, that this may be a prophecy that's not publicized at this time. That was what I said two or three weeks ago.
The part about Assyria.
The part about the Babylonians.
Yeah, but yes.
The Assyrians, he's talked about explicitly.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, God willing, we have class next week, and then we're off for 2 weeks after that. But next week, April 9th, God willing, we are here. Thank you very much.